Completely Conspicuous, episode 442, October 19th, 2016. Welcome back to Completely Conspicuous. I'm your host, Jay Kumar. This week it's part two of my conversation with Greg Renoff as we discuss the rise and fall of the Guitar Hero. As always, please send any comments, questions, or fifth party candidates to j.kumar@gmail.com. Also, please check out Completely Conspicuous at comconcast.blogspot.com and on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at coomdog, and you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And now back to my conversation with Greg Renoff. So, I guess, you know, getting into the 80s, obviously, you know, for me, you know, Van Halen was prominent, you know, Randy Rhoads and Ozzy, and, you know, and then sort of hair metal came along. What, you know, what were you into that stuff right away, or did it take you a while to kind of get into it?
Yeah, it all kind of followed along. For me, the entry point was Van Halen 1984, and then you buy the Circus magazine, or you watch Friday Night Videos, and, oh, there's a rap video played before Jump, and there's a Motley Crue video played after a rap video, and you sort of you start there. Yeah, that was definitely for me. Yeah, you know, Quiet Riot, Rat, all those bands were all part and parcel of what I was going to be listening to when I was a sophomore in high school, or whenever that was, freshman high school. Yeah, definitely.
See, because I got into Iron Maiden and Priest a few years before sort of the hair metal really started, so I kind of got into that whole, you know, British new wave of British heavy metal, right. You know, early Def Leppard, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of, you know, I jumped on board with Maiden Japan, and then obviously Number of the Beast and that kind of stuff. But, you know, when the hair metal stuff started coming out, obviously, yeah, I was into I liked Rat because they just, you know, they had a good sound. And I saw actually my first concert was at the fairgrounds in the town I lived in New Hampshire, and it was Cheap Trick, who were kind of on the downslide at the time. This is like 1984, with Rat, Twisted Sister, and Lita Ford opening up. And it was like, that was just like, you know, middle of July, 85 degrees, and we were, you know, places, I don't know, like 30,000 people, and we were just like going nuts. You know, and I, you know, Twisted Sister puts on a great show. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but like, you know, musically, obviously they weren't like, you know, as technically proficient as a band like Rat, but they were so much fun.
Yeah.
And then obviously Rat was just like, that was when Routed Round had just come out. So they were huge. So I definitely kind of got into it. You know, for me, it was more the music than the, you know, the Hairspray, but, or the look, but, you know, certainly there were a lot of those bands that I was listening to. And Motley Crue, too.
The fall of 84, you know, I had a tape that I wish I still had. I still had the tape just for sentimental reasons, but it fell apart. It was 1984 on one side and Rat on the other, Rat Out of the Cellar.
Yep.
You know, that was the one that was in the boombox the whole summer long. You'd play, you know, you'd play one side, then you'd just flip it over and play the other side. So I heard that Rat was touring and was looking for tour dates, and I don't know where I saw it in a magazine or something, or heard an ad on the radio. It's possible an ad on the radio would have been played because I lived in New York at the time, and it was Billy Squire with opening act Rat at Nassau Coliseum, and I may have told you the story before. So super excited. So this is again probably September, October 1984. So I go with my cousin to Nassau Coliseum, and we show up expecting Rat. And we find out, I think I found out that at the day of the show, but it couldn't have been very far away from the show if I didn't find out the day of the show, that it was going to be Molly Hatchet. And so what had happened is that Rat had jumped off of the Billy Squire tour because the numbers were dropping, because Billy Squire had really damaged his career. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I remember the Nassau Coliseum was pretty like half full, maybe. I don't remember. I'd love to know the attendance of that show. I probably could find it in Polestar if you could pull an old Polestar or something. But it was definitely obvious that Billy Squire had taken a big hit to his career. And crazy? So that was like a crushing thing for me. Of course, now I think it's hilarious that I got to see Molly Hatchet and sort of their ZZ Top. I don't know if you know stuff that they did in that round. They did it with one of ZZ Top's producers. They did that record, and there's a song called Satisfied Man. Anyone listening to this, go on YouTube and watch Satisfied Man by Molly Hatchet. It's like such a great ZZ. It's like, you know, we got to make you guys sound like ZZ Top. Oh, it's great. It's great. And the video is I don't want to ruin the video for you, but let me just tell you that the barbarian character that's on all the records comes to life in the video. It's just fantastic. 80s, classic 80s video. And so that was a big blow. I ended up seeing Rat and Bon Jovi the following year. They toured together and Bon Jovi blew Rat off the stage.
Really?
Yeah. That was an eye opener for me as a kid. Bon Jovi was a band I knew from being from New Jersey, but they were touring 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm almost positive. Yeah. They would have been touring for that. And John Bon Jovi came out with his band and, you know, he had the Jersey hometown thing to it, so they definitely had a fan base in New Jersey even early on before they were monstrous. I mean, there were a lot of kids there to see Bon Jovi, but I was just remember Bon Jovi on the piano dancing and singing, and he was just a great performer, arena performer. He just was great, and I remember going, "Wow, this is kind of get this sort of all about Rat," and I was sort of like, "Wow, these other bands can kind of come in here and really, it's possible for an opening act to really take it to." A headliner in a way that I hadn't expected, and that was a big eye opener for me. For lack of a better term, to see the opening act can overcome a headliner. It was supposedly a better band, and it was clear that Bon Jovi was the better band.
Well, and you know, and I'm guessing by that point, Rad had been living it up on the success of the first album, and probably were starting to get a little excessive in their partying. Because they definitely had some issues with that, not too long after that. Certainly the opening act, you know all about it with Van Halen, their first tour and what they did to, Black Sabbath and other bands. Just, when you've got kind of a hot young act that's, hungry, you got to watch out.
Yeah, and it was clear that Bon Jovi was hungry, and that John Bon Jovi. In later years, I went to enough concerts where you started to see where opening acts were kind of getting the screw job, where there was almost no room on the stage, and
right.
The
sound wasn't as good.
Yeah, right. So this was, there was Rat was headlining, but it was Bon Jovi was not a band that was they weren't going to try to screw them. And surely, I think the other thing was I'm sure. Rat's management at the time understood that Bon Jovi was selling tickets, and it's sort of like, well, right. So why would we try to, screw a band that is bringing people in the door? So we're not going to do that. And so, maybe in the long term that didn't make a difference to Rat's career. I don't know or not, but Bon Jovi was, people were there early to see Bon Jovi. I'll say that.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Billy Squire too, a year before that show that you were going to see, with Squire, he was touring with, I remember, with Def Leppard opened for Squire in 83, and that was right when Pyromania came out.
Right.
He was still doing well, but obviously Def Leppard was the hot band. There's always, and I'm sure he was the hot, when The Stroke came out, he was opening for other bands and probably was, in that role as well. So, I guess it's just, year to year that can change, if you go from opener to headliner. And yeah, you know, I think obviously with hair metal, you know, it kind of went from, you know, first it was kind of about the music, and then it got, you know, it just started getting silly, like, you know, bands like Poison, and, you know, even like, I mean, Motley Crue, I remember when they kind of first came out, and, you know, really were doing the makeup, and everybody was kind of like going, oh my God, what's up with that? But, I mean, you know, but they had the songs, you know, Poison, and Poison was catchy, but like, you know, they kind of, you know, they had, you know, they inspired Cinderella, and Cinderella inspired, you know, I don't know, Naughty Naughty or whoever, you know, all these bands that like, you know, were just amping it up, and, you know, I don't know how much substance was there, but, you know, through it all, there was still, you know, you still had to have a hot shit guitarist, you know, who could play the solos, you know?
You know, it's interesting. Looking back on those bands, it's almost now to me perfectly clear that it was a bubble. You know, just like you have a stock bubble, mm-hmm. in a sector of the economy, like, oh, it's a biotech bubble, and all these, you know, all these stocks are getting overvalued because the biotech bubble is hot. The same thing was happening with those bands. There was all these bands who were really, really, very good were getting overvalued. It was inevitable that it was never going to last. And we see this over and over with different genres of music where things kind of get played out and there's this big shift. You know, for me, it sort of became impossible to keep up after a while, too. You'd see these new bands and, yeah, you would...
Tora.
Yeah, whatever, right. And so at some point, you know, I was getting ready to go to college and it just became, you know, less important for me to get every issue of Circus Magazine, sort of right. have that obsessive... You know, I wasn't, you know, you're not surviving high school anymore. You've kind of made it through. But yeah, after a while, it was just these, you know, and there were bands that would come out that I would love. Extreme, for example, the first mm-hmm. couple of Extreme records, loved those. And they were,
I liked Porno Graffiti. I thought that was.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, loved it.
That was a good record.
I loved it.
And then they kind of got a little too full of themselves, you know, with the three. The triple album right after that. I was like, geez.
Yeah, the Beatles stuff. Yeah, it's so. I think I was still in some sort of way trying to seek out, you know, the Guitar Heroes to get us back to our conversation. Seek out those Guitar Heroes. So Nuno, you know, the Guitar Magazines featured Nuno, and I sort of picked up the album and thought, wow, the songs are great. And that for me was what it came down to, too. You know, I also would read Guitar Magazine reviews, and there'd be a review of some of these guitar player records, these heavy metal records with these shredder guitar players, and I get them, and I'm like, well, the songs aren't very good. And I got to the point where eventually got to the point where I realized, yeah, for me, I need the melody, I need the song, I need something that's going to hook me more than just a guitar solo. But I do have a very good friend of mine named Paul who would tell me he would get albums and just fast forward to the guitar solos. And that's, he would do that. He would, oh yeah, I just fast forward to the guitar solos for whatever band. I love the guitar solos. And so that's what he would do. But yeah, I was like, yeah, that's exactly it. You have to, you know, the songs aren't good enough. The solos are great. And I don't know if he ever made himself a compilation tape of just the solos cut up, but that was what he would do.
Well, he didn't have to, because by, you know, 85 or so, Yngwie Malmsteen, you know, kind of led the wave of just these, you know, these ridiculously fast guitarists. Who primarily just played solos for a whole record. I mean, yep. What was your take on, you know, there was Yngwie, there was, I remember this guy, Chris Impellitteri, I think I had a cassette of his, Paul Chastain.
That was the one, yeah, I had, that was the, one of the records I got, the Chastain record,
CJSS. Ruler of the Waste.
Yeah. Yeah, Ruler of the Waste, one of those, I picked it up, and, you know, I'm sure he sold a few hundred thousand copies of those records when they came out. And I just remember thinking, yeah, for me, the songs just weren't good enough. But yeah, Yngwie, the one I started with was Rising Force.
Yep, me too.
On vinyl. I still have the copy. And that was great. I thought I loved it. And then I got Marching Out, which came out in 85. And I thought it was a good record. And I thought the songs were pretty good. But as every subsequent Yngwie record came along, I really felt they were not as good as the one that came before it, and I sort of, he was evolving into something that I liked less and less and less.
And the, you know, there was just like it seemed like the arms race was just to find the fastest guitarist out there who could play like the longest solo. You know, there were so many of these guys that were getting signed left and right. I think it was Metal Blade was signing a lot of them, but then like then Satriani came along and Steve Vai. But at least, you know, they were kind of a list, you know, more tuneful. And obviously Vai, you know, latched on with David Lee Roth and kind of sent his career into a whole different place. But, it was an interesting time because sort of you had the twin tracks of you sort of had that hair metal thing going on one end. And then you had sort of the guitar, you know, virtuoso. And I think the funniest combination of the two was Vinnie Vincent. With Vinnie Vincent Invasion, and I've recommended this to anybody who wants a good laugh is to look up an old Vinnie Vincent Invasion video, because like literally there's like a couple of songs that are just 75% solo, it's just him playing as fast as he can.
Well, and the other amazing thing about that is the singer he had, the first singer he had was Robert Fleischman, who if you go back and there's some live footage. He was in Journey for some stretch of time right before Perry joins. And he's like this unbelievable voice, this great melodic rock voice that was – he wrote Wheel in the Sky. He didn't sing on it on the album, but he wrote that song.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There was he wrote Wheel in the Sky with Neil Sean, I think he wrote it with. And you listen to his voice and you think this guy's got a voice that should have been on every radio station in the country. And you listen to the Vinnie Vincent record, and it doesn't sound anything like what he's doing. Doesn't sound anything like the way he sang prior. Now, I'm not saying he's not a great singer. He is, but it's interesting. Like you're saying, the solos were so over the top. The vocal style was so over the top too. The whole thing.
And then they kicked him out before they even did the video, and they got Mark Slaughter in the band to lip sync the songs in the videos, and then basically the whole band became Slaughter, except for Vinny. But that was like, I think the most extreme, you know, and obviously, you know, Vinnie Vincent, for anybody who doesn't know, was in Kiss for a couple of years, right around the time that they unmasked, especially I think the Lick It Up album was probably his biggest contribution. But, you know, it was almost like he was sort of saying, all right, this is all the stuff that Kiss wouldn't let me do,
Definitely. And then there was a band called Nitro, which I was not on my radio screen when I was a teenager, but I have a friend, Rob, who enjoys the ironic aspects of metal, likes metal, but likes the ironic aspects, and he sends me the video, and they have a song called OFR, Out Fucking Rageous, and so that was the title of the album, and so, but it's Michael Baddio. Michelangelo Baddio, right? Yep. So there's these incredible, you know, he's like, so, like you're saying, so it's just so over the top, the vocals, the guitar playing was so over the top, it honestly is like Vinnie Vincent Invasion taking up two or three notches.
And he had the guitar with the necks in each direction,
correct.
So he could play with both hands.
Correct.
That was ridiculous, I remember that dude. And Jim Gillette later married Lita Ford. And then got divorced.
Yeah. And so that was then the moment that I didn't, you know, no one, I don't think anyone saw coming unless you were, I think, had this sort of 20,000 foot view of the music industry at the time, probably said this isn't going to last. But then the bubble eventually bursts. And would you remember when you sort of saw the end coming of the hair metal / Guitar Hero worship that was so built up around that type of music?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I think the most obvious thing is just to point to Nirvana, but even before that, you could kind of see that, that kind of music just the alternative music was definitely kind of becoming more of a thing. You know, bands like Jane's Addiction we're getting, you know, and even like Living Color, you know, so there's still guitar. Like, I mean, Dave Navarro's an incredible guitar player. Vernon Reed's an incredible guitar player, you know, so you could still hear guitar music, but it was, people were writing about like, you know, different things than just like, you know, let's, you know, party all night and, you know, go get laid. So it was, you know, when a band like Warrant, you know, I think actually I would almost point to Cherry Pie as sort of like the tipping point, because like I remember seeing that video and going, and it was a catchy song, but I was like, good God, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen and or heard. And really, like, that was almost a death knell for a while. And, you know, even like the bands that weren't doing stuff like that just got totally shunned for a decade at least.
Right. I just looked to see when that came out. That was September 1990. Yeah. So I guess when that album came out. And yeah, I mean, that was sort of that was where you had these bands like Warrant, which were I don't know what that was at that point, third, fourth generation. And yeah, and it was, then they had 50 bands that were like them that you would see pimped in Hit Parade or Magazine or Circus Magazine or wherever, or the radio or MTV was trying to break these bands. You know, the record companies, like MCA's got some band that's like Warrant. They're trying to break this band. Right. Sleazebees, which they had some good songs. Yeah, right. All of these bands like this, and it just became so hard to differentiate them because they were all doing one variation. You know, well, they were either Guns N' Roses ripoff or Aerosmith ripoff or Van Halen ripoff. It was just all sort of.
And they were doing. They all had to have the power ballad. You know, that was kind of the thing too. Is like, yeah. You know, Every Rose Has Its Thorn became a huge hit. So then everybody's, you know. Home Sweet Home became a big hit, so everybody's got to do like their own sweeping power ballad. So it just became so cliched, you know.
The other thing I remember too is the campaign. Oh, here we are in the midst of a presidential campaign, which we won't talk about. But 1992, I remember distinctly as Bill Clinton was gaining momentum. He came out of the primaries and eventually became the nominee, and there was this. This coalition forming, there were people who were unhappy with the Bush-Reagan years, and you could sort of sense that something was happening in the culture. I don't know how to explain. Like MTV was sort of gravitating towards that. They sort of saw this as the end.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And that was, you know, that was actually the warning bell, you know, before the end. It was sort of like, you know, record companies, it's the change is coming. And it came soon after, when Nirvana broke big and all the Seattle bands started to break big. But you could see it, the energy starting to shift in the culture, this sort of embrace of hedonism and all the stuff that the hair metal bands wrapped their heads around. That was all going to come to a crashing halt once you had this shift coming, which was, I think, a good part to have to do with what was going on in the politics at the time.
Absolutely. And then you had also, you know, I think with the rise of alternative rock, you know, you had bands like U2 and REM, you know, really kind of not just, you know, having hits, but also, you know, speaking to the sort of social conscience side of things, were very, you know, vocal on that. You know, you had Peter Gabriel, and you had sort of artists who were kind of going beyond just, you know, right, like, you know, like we said, writing about partying. So it almost was like metal was, you know, hard rock and metal was just kind of lumped into as this unserious, you know, narcissistic, and ultimately just, you know, irrelevant art form. And it kind of got just shunted off to Europe, you know, because that's where all the bands went. You know, bands like Maiden and Scorpions just went over there and played festivals and made tons of money. You know, and I, you know, for my part, you know, I went to college from 85 to 89. And certainly, you know, I arrived there with, you know, two boxes of records. One was just metal albums and one was, you know, sort of just everything else. And, you know, I think by the time I graduated, I wasn't listening to the metal albums at all, you know? And really I kind of stepped away from it for a lot of years just because, you know, I got more into like the alternative stuff and you know, less into the Guitar Hero stuff. And that's why, you know, I was, you know, I think we were kind of joking around on Twitter the other day, but like, I paid no attention to Van Halen after 1991, you know, for Unlawful Unlawful Carnage. Carnal Knowledge.
For Unlawful Carnage.
It might as well be, right? But yeah, like I had that record in it, and then I just was like, yeah, I don't really like this. So I just, you know, I didn't listen to it. And then I didn't even, like, I've never heard a note from Balance. You know, like I barely remember when it came out. And then I knew about the Sharon album just because, you know, it kind of, you know, I read some stories about it, but like I didn't, you know, pay attention to it until many years later. But and only then as a joke. but you know, but like a lot of those bands just, you know, I think Van Halen still sold a decent amount of records, probably not compared to what they used to, but you know, a lot of those hard rock bands just, you know, it was a dead decade for them, probably a dead decade and a half. Now it's kind of like, it feels like bands are sort of at least able to revisit, you know, what they used to do. And they, you know, people aren't embarrassed to be metal fans anymore, or guitar fans anymore. Although, you know, you certainly aren't going to hear it on the radio so much.
Do you think, the idea of the Guitar Hero is dead or dying, or
I mean, I think, well, I think it's sort of right now it's a nostalgic thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, is there, I don't see so many kids coming up saying like, I'm going to be the next big Guitar Hero. Cause there's, you know, you're not going to make any money doing it. It doesn't seem, unless you're, you know, a Guitar Hero who plays in Iron Maiden or Van Halen, who can, you know, command, you know, generations of fans to come to your arena shows. But if you're like a kid starting out, I imagine it's a tough racket to be in a metal band. I mean there are young metal acts that play, but you know, they're certainly not commercially viable, really, at least like not the way they were in the 80s anyways.
I just saw this band, and they're not really a metal band, I just saw this band, the Struts. I don't know if you're familiar with this band. I saw them,
heard of them,
you know. Yeah, so they are you know, they're sort of what the Darkness, I think, could have been. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in only the best sort of way. So they've sort of borrowed from the Stones and they borrowed from Queens. This is the Struts.
Yep.
And it has some really catchy songs. So I saw them play at a place called the Diamond Ballroom in Oklahoma City. The thing I was thinking when I saw the show was, guitarist played through a Les Paul, had a nice pedal board, had some nice gear, good guitar tone, and, you know, kind of was, you know, he's rooted in that 70s type of guitar playing that you and I probably enjoyed. Not tons of flashy solos. I mean, he's not doing Jimmy Page stuff up there, but mm-hmm. that's definitely all part of the equation. And they were playing, and they're really a great live band, great. And they had about, I don't know, maybe 500 people there. I don't know. I'm not very good at estimating the size of crowds. 500 people there. The place was you know, it's like this sort of this barn structure, so you could pack probably four times more people in there than they had in there. But every single person in there was into the show, and they had this big big connection with their fans. And but I was thinking at the same time, yeah, this is a band that I can't remember what label they're on, but they're on a major label, and you know, they're touring on a bus and everything. But they're, you know, it's because of the way, let's face it, with the way the average teenager looks at things, they don't sort of gravitate towards that type of music. It's much more, you know, Drake, these other things that are going to be mm-hmm. more likely to catch the attention. Pop music is so big now. I mean, it's just absurd how big it is. Look at the streams on Spotify for some of these acts that are just monstrous. But what I did think about this band, that yes, they have a guy in there who in a different world, I could imagine, like in the 80s, like could have been a guy that would have been admired for his guitar playing. And again, because not because he was doing Guitar Hero stuff, but I imagine that in the 80s, producers would have said, oh, you got to do more solos. It would have been more of a focus on his rather than on the songs. It would have been more focused on his playing.
Right.
But what I did see there that night, which gave me some sliver of hope, there were a lot of teenage girls there, a lot. And so these guys do like the glitter makeup and everything, and they do like it's like a glam glitter throwback band, but the songs are straightforwardly pop rock songs. And I thought, wow, they have a lot of it's not an insignificant number of teenage girls, and I thought this is a good thing. These girls were up against the barricade singing the songs, and I thought, well, you know, they're. If any band is going to be able to break into something a little bit bigger, these guys will. And they've opened for Aerosmith. They've opened for Motley Crue. I think they opened the last Motley Crue shows, the ones the final shows before they shut it down. And so, you know, they there is this I think, void for people like you and me who are looking for young bands. There are some other bands we could talk about, Rival Sun, some other bands I really like. But, you know, for sort of the teenage girl, you know, which is what you and I remember distinctly, I'm sure, by going to see Rat and Doc, and there were tons and tons and tons of girls.
That was probably another part of the attraction for the guys, was that there's going to be a tons of girls there. You know?
Yes, definitely, definitely. And so I saw this, and I thought, this is promising that 14-year-old girls with their some, you know, with their boyfriends or with right. their group of friends are there to see this English cute English boys playing this what we would recognize as Queen, Stonesy, sure. yeah. Motley Fool type of nostalgia songs, but they're, you know, they're a good band.
I love that stuff
fun band.
Too, you know?
They're fun. I mean, really fun band.
Well, you know, and I have a teenage daughter and one who's almost a teenage daughter, and they're big into pop. So they're listening to, you know, the top 40 stations, and they know, you know, all the new songs, and they, you know, they're not like, not hugely into hip hop. They're more into like, they like a little bit of it, but they like, you know, Taylor Swift and stuff like that. But they, you know, they are not into guitar rock, which is what their dad listens to all the time. But
Why they call it dad rock?
Yeah, I guess. But I, you know, I don't try to, you know, I know some guys over the years who have tried to like kind of, you know, get their kids into, you know, like I have one buddy who, you know, big music fan and you know, would try to get his kids to listen to The Who and Elvis Costello right. and The Beatles, and they would like it for a while, but then eventually they just kind of gravitated to, you know, more poppy stuff. Although is one of his daughters is kind of into, you know, that whole kind of Lumineers, Mumford and Sons scene. And so he's ended up having to like, you know, he takes her to all these shows and she's like way into it. So like they're always like, you know, getting autographs and going backstage
yeah.
and stuff for these bands. But I kind of laugh at him. But, you know, it's cool. You know, she loves the music. So, you know, I can't be too critical. But yeah, my girls are definitely not into the stuff I listen to. That's for
no.
Sure.
And I also have doubts about the future of guitar as the driving force for, you know, commercial music, whatever you want to call it. I just think so much more music is being made on electronics, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't think that, you know, there will be a time where there'll be no guitar records produced or people won't be using guitar as an instrument, but it just seems that that era that we're talking about, as we sort of, you know, kind of wrap this up, it's like there was this idolatry of the guitar hero.
Yeah.
It arises in the late 60s, it goes to the 70s, it goes to the 80s, and it continues. I mean, it's still there too. Guitar World magazine's still going. Steve Vai, these other guys are still out there making a living and playing, and people love these guitar players. And there's plenty of teenage kids you see on YouTube all the time who are taking up a guitar. And so it's not as if it's sort of, you know, it's not like you're going from to something where it's an extinction situation, but I think
but
the idea that
it's not a cultural force anymore.
No.
Which, and you know, what did you think of Guitar Hero? Do you remember the game Guitar Hero? About 10 years ago was kind of a big thing where, you know, you had the kid, you know, you were basically playing like a plastic, you know, simulation of a guitar, you know, trying to play these songs on a video game. You know, what were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my nephews had the game. I tried to play it a couple times, and you know, it's just one of those things where you're just like, I'm just not interested enough to try to play it, although it was entertaining, and I would, I don't remember what they were playing, like a, you know, Joan Jett, I Love Rock and Roll, and I said, put on Van Halen, and they would do the Van Halen song for me. I remember distinctly the narrative in the media being, oh, well, this is going to bring guitar playing back for kids in a way, and it didn't. I mean, it just made them play the video game. Now, I, you know, do I think it was probably good for the bank accounts and the cultural visibility of a guy like Slash? I think for sure. I mean, you ask pretty much any teenage kid who Slash is, they know who Slash is, and they may know Slash because of the Guitar Hero game. Now, they may not be into Guns N' Roses. They may not want to play guitar, but they know who Slash is.
My kids know who Slash is because he was on Phineas and Ferb.
Yeah, I mean, right? And so there's that, I think for some individuals that may have, like, brought their, I don't know who else would be other than Slash, but I don't think in the big scheme of things, it helped those bands that much develop a following among more new young guitar players. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I'd love to hear maybe someone email you or something and say, oh, you're wrong, or email me and say we're
I think it got certain songs. Like, you know, actually any kind of video game placement, it seems like, you know, if you get, like, there's a lot of, you know, like, Grand Theft Auto and a lot of these kind of game, you know, have a lot of songs, you know, sort of older songs in them. And sometimes I'll be like watching a video on YouTube and, you know, you'll see comments and like, oh yeah, I came here because of GTA or something like that. You know, so it's kind of funny that people are learning about music from video games.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The songs, definitely. Right. Oh yeah. I remember the song Grand Theft Auto. Yeah. Our friends, I'll have like, that's something that sounds like my nephew would say or something, like, oh yeah, this song was in Grand Theft Auto.
Or even in a movie or something when there's an older song.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, music goes in cycles, and, you know, we're definitely in a pop cycle right now. But, you know, that could, you know, I think at some point that's going to change. I don't know if it's going to, we're ever going to go back to, you know, 1985 again. But, you know.
Yeah, and no, and I don't think so. And it's sort of in my bleakest view of the future, I see, you know, I had this thing in the back of my mind. I read somewhere that, you know, at one point in time, like, the accordion was the main featured instrument in a lot of music that was heard on the radio. You know, it's just, you know,
ukuleles.
Yeah, right. You're thinking, like, is the electric guitar going to be like that or you know? And so, yeah, I just, for me, I just love guitar playing, and I kind of understand that it was a, era in time. It's not going to come back the way it was. I would always like to see people express themselves on guitar in a way that emotionally connects with me. And so, you know, people will solo differently in the future or whatever. I would love to see that continue. But yeah, it's kind of hard for me to believe that there'll be this idolatry of these guys, the Eddie Van Halen. There'll eventually be a time where a guitar player will be so revered that my mom would know, you know, someone's mom would know the name. Oh, I know that guitar player, Van Halen. You know, that, I just find it hard to imagine where that would happen.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen again. But, you know, the good thing is that we were able to live through, you know, that entire era, and we're here to talk about it. So
it survived.
That's right. So, Greg Renoff, thanks for taking the time and sharing your memories of Guitar Heroes past and present.
Hey, it was fun. Anytime. Right. And thanks for having me on.
All right, man.
Talk to you.
All right.
You are listening to Completely Conspicuous with Jay Kumar.
And that wraps up episode 442 of Completely Conspicuous. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time when Brian Salvatore and I discuss the best music of the year 1985. In the meantime, check out BFF.fm every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 Pacific, to hear my radio show Stuck in the Garage. Check out Mixcloud.com/CoomDog to listen to archived shows. Jay Breitling produced the opening and closing themes of this show. Voiceover work is courtesy of James Grailian. Completely Conspicuous is a Tan God production.